we will start with group one.
Thank you. Again, we had a very good discussion. We, in our group, we started the discussion with the question three, because this question is more generic question than the other questions. So we discussed whether or not we should address for comparability and the flexibility. Can we achieve both? Actually, it's a difficult question. Of course, idealistically, to achieve both is very idealistic. However, maybe we need to discuss whether we can achieve it both or not. Then what we concluded is principle basis very important. Basically, we have to approach this one. We have to address this issue with a principle basis. And somehow, if we could lead some idea to provide a comparability from the principle basis, that is the idealistic solution. Based on that agreement, we discussed the EBIT. And the EBIT is will be a good anchor for providing comparability. So therefore, basically providing EBIT is very good. However, the question is how we can differentiate the financial cost and income and other expense and income. That is the most difficult questions. And currently, there was some example about capital structure. So in some jurisdictions, it is required to keep the reservation, to keep the liquidity. So the reservation must be this certain amount of the liability. So therefore, if the liability is bigger, reservation will be bigger. And that reservation could be long-term investment. So if we define some financial income and income and expense based on the liability plus cash and the cash equivalent, then that wouldn't meet the situation like this. So therefore, again, coming back to the third question, the principle basis is more important. That is what we discussed here. And also regarding, with respect to the financial income and expense, we discussed whether or not IS 19 type liability discount rewinding would be part of the financial cost, or the discount rewinding of decommissioning reservation would be the part of the financial income or expense. We agreed one clear answer. So as far as IS 90 type liability, it should be part of the finance income and expense, because this is kind of creating financial resources, because it is almost same as borrowing money. This is because the company has a choice to do that. And whereas decommissioning reservation is somehow kind of provisioning made by the management estimate. So that is that completely different. So therefore, IS 90 liability goes to financial income and expense, but decommissioning wouldn't. That is what we have discussed. And with respect to management performance measure, basically, we agree that having management performance measure is good, and it would be audited. It will give some discipline to the presentation. However, the views was departed for the constraint on the management performance measure. Most participants agreed number three is the best way. And however, one participant says maybe number five okay, because currently we have such a situation. So we have APM outside of the financial statement. If we take in that number, then that will solve the APM issue. However, it should be explained very clearly as long as it is clearly explained, then even number five would be acceptable. That is the minority opinion, but there was an opinion like this. That is.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. I think before I open for comments and discussion, we will hear all the groups, and next is Francois.
Okay, so I don't really feel in the capacity of reflecting the wealth of input and eventually of various views that were expressed in the group, but I will nevertheless have an attempt to it. First of all, the preamble to this summary is that we leave financial institutions out because they're at this stage they present characteristics that would not necessarily fit with the comments that have been made. So in the group we took the questions in the order they were presented, so started with whether there would be merit in the definition of an EBIT as a starting point for comparability purposes. And even though there was no unanimous support for that, there was a majority building about the idea that for comparability purposes, this would be beneficial. And this depends really heavily whether we are in the capacity of defining the capital structure in a robust manner. This robust manner having to be assessed from a comparability purpose, not necessarily on any other basis. And when it came to how this capital structure would be defined, then the wealth of diverse views arose again. Some wishing to have an EBIT as close as possible of what could be an operating profit, others feeling that what should be in the capital structure is everything that is interest sensitive. So quite a wide range of views. Nevertheless, despite these diverse views, an agreement that whatever that in every all interest expenses, whether they arise from what is defined as a capital structure or from other elements, should be below the EBIT line. So that was on question one. On question two, the message we received was loud and clear. IFRS is not in the business of making non-GAAP measures IFRS. The value of IFRS is in the standardization that we're able to trigger. So let management define their performance measure, but do not call a management defined performance measure an IFRS number. Nevertheless, there is a value in trying to disaggregate more in the income statement above the EBIT line. And there is also agreement on the fact that there would be value in defining non-recurring items in order to single them out on the face. Beyond that, and in order to have a better understanding of the elements that are profitability drivers, there is a call for having a better disaggregation by nature of a certain number of expenses, whether that is within a function, by function presentation. When it is within that presentation. And also last point that was made was that there is a need for having a good linkage with the cash flow statement. We didn't get to question three because basically the question, the response to question two was giving, two and one was giving the answer to question three.
Okay, thank you. I think very interesting views. And let's hear what group three, Gary.
Thank you. The I think in the main, sort of consistent views with the first two presentations on IBIT. There is pretty broad support for the direction of flow. Probably some reservations about can you ever actually get there, but nonetheless, support for the direction and the attempt to try. I think the mostly focused on, I'll call it the tactical issues, and the exact same issues that we've been wrestling with the board came up. What do you do about equity affiliates? What do you do about financial institutions? What do you do about captive finance companies and so on and so on? And are they operations? Are they not? Are they something else? And so on. There's also a suggestion maybe it'd be easier to approach it focusing on interest on long-term liabilities as opposed to trying to define capital structure. On the management approach, there was actually very strong direction for trying. Like other groups, sort of gravitated around item 3 on slide 16, a little bit of support for number 4, but no support for the others. The wide support that the table, the multi-year table of infrequent items or above or below the line items is absolutely critical to all of this. Suggestion, we should probably focus in terms of what are the one-offs on the lumpiness of the charge as opposed to the frequency or infrequency of the charge. And again, I think that's sort of consistent with the style of the talking. There's a long debate about labeling and nomenclature. Be careful with using operations, earnings, income, and so on. And while you're doing it, don't mess up or conflict with the industry segment table. And I think probably paraphrase where we came out on it, support for considerable management flexibility with full transparency, I.e. accounting policy choice with the table.
Okay, thanks, Gary. And the last group, Steve.
Probably not a great deal to add. There was a lot of overlap, obviously, between the groups. Certainly on EBIT, the investors were pretty keen on having this. Preparers a little bit more skepticism. Is this really necessary? A cost benefit came up once or twice. And then also the questions of associates and these other difficult to deal with items. On the management performance measures, again, general support from the investors, thought this was could be useful. We also gravitated around 3 and 4 in the constraints, so nobody suggested 1 or 2 in that area. Certainly support for making sure that it was transparent, reconciled, if there were changes, then restate previous years. And I think the preparers also sort of on board with it. So long as it wasn't constrained, then that's fine. Some talk about consistency across the annual reporting package and segment reporting and management commentary and the importance of trying to not necessarily line up entirely, but to at least have some consistency across there. And in terms of should we pursue this, then generally yes, worthwhile exploring it further and issuing a discussion paper and getting feedback and see where we go from here.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. And interesting, I think, is that at least with one exception of the groups, everybody supported the direction, but group 2, I think, said, okay, that at least this management performance measure it's not a good idea to have it in the financial statement, then maybe we can a little bit discuss that, a little bit more detail why your group really thinking that it's not a good idea and maybe it takes the views of others. But having that said, also any other comments are welcome. So opening the discussion.
So, Kevin? So, Tuck, I was just interested in your group's view on decommissioning.
Yeah.
Because I have a closed DB fund and my pensioners are all going to die long before I close my mines. And so I think my long-term liability is decommissioning, not necessarily the pension fund. Mm.
Yeah.
I think it's very unique to industries than this sort of general conclusion that decommissioning is a provision.
Yes, I agree. But what we have discussed is basically whether or not IS-19 type liability is a part of the financial income expense or not. And the discussion we have is in the case of pension liability, a company have a choice. But they can ask to the insurance company whatever, but instead of doing that, they can get gaining the resources. So therefore, it should be a part of the financial activity, the capital, part of the capital structure. However, including decommissioning, with respect to the provisioning type, then it is the liability which may or may not occur in the future, and then the company make a provision in the accounting, and then in the calculation they recognize interest expenses. So the nature itself is quite different. That is what we discussed.
I may add to Kevin's question that at least the companies that I look at, they may have a trust connected to the pension liability. The trust may be 10% of the liability or 110% of the liability. And to me, it's quite clear that you end up with very different liabilities depending on that trust. Mm. That is one thing. Also in Sweden, they can sell the pension liability to an insurance company. And if they want to have money, they can borrow money from the insurance company. And if I look at provisions for like tearing down a nuclear plant 30 years from now, that is something that someone forces on me. It's not a financing decision that I make. And eventually I have to use the money for a certain purpose. So it's distinct, different to me, a provision for pensioning compared to provision for future costs.
Yeah, but in mining, I can choose to commence restoration of a pit now, or I can choose at some point in time. As long as I restore it before my license expires, I've complied with my requirements. So I have a lot of choice as to when I want to do that cash flow, and whether I therefore, that interest cost that it grows by is definitely a function of my potential.
But would you regard that as a financing decision?
No different than making a decision to settle the pension fund early.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't follow you. Sorry.
Take it on the side. Or maybe you can take that after and claim.
I can make a contribution to that. in the nuclear industry in Europe, you have a contractual liability to cough up for decommissioning. The biggest element of this is what is called stage one decommissioning, which is the tearing down of the nuclear plant. That is a pretty known cost. Okay, there's nothing uncertain about that cost. It's about tearing down a structure that's been radiated. It's been done a few times, and we know what that costs. That's the bulk of what the nuclear provisions are in these things, and it occurs reasonably soon after a nuclear plant has been shut down. The problem is that a lot of these nuclear plants were originally expected to shut down a long time in the future. In a lot of cases, this has been brought forward by moratoria, shutdowns, early shutdowns, etc. And so that's brought the issue very close up front to the companies who have to face this problem almost immediately. Now, the problem is this. So there's an element of operating cost in this because you can't operate a nuclear facility without incurring these costs. So just like digging the ground and building the facility and amortizing the buildings and the PPE and all that kind of stuff, you have this cost. The only difference is that it's going to occur after the revenues have been earned. That's the big problem. Once you've shut down the plant, you're earning nothing, but you've got a liability for costs out in the future. Could be like pensions. Okay, so you could have a pension. It's exactly analogous to pensions in this. Now the question is this: do you set aside 100 quid today because you 100 quid, you know, 100 quid today because you need 100 quid tomorrow, or do you set aside an amount today, which bearing in mind how much it could earn if you invested it properly, it would produce 100 in a few years' time, is the question. Most companies have chosen to do the second, which is to say they've discounted it based on current levels of interest rate. Economic substance tells you that what they're doing is they're recognizing the bond elements in the nuclear provisions. They have contractual liability. They're not making an estimate of a future cost that may or may not occur. They have a contractual liability to do it. The only problem is, and they have a legal obligation to do it, but it's definitely contractual. Each one of us could go and sue the company for that, to fulfill that obligation, public service obligation. They've discounted that. And because they've discounted that, the provisions are sensitive to the rate of interest. So now one of the things that's very interesting is that as the interest rate has come down, the global interest rates have come down, the provisions, of course, have gone up. This is exactly what you'd expect from a piece of debt that was discounted by interest rates. And as interest rates go up now, guess what? Those provisions are going to come down. The profits are going to go up. So we have companies here whose profit is very sensitive to financing, in the same way as if they had borrowed floating rate debt, in exactly the same way. There's no difference. So the substance over form tells you, if we're going to follow that rule, that we have something that looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, right? We can decide it's a pig, but it looks like a duck.
Okay, thank you for that.
Yeah, can I move to a question number two? I think the biggest challenge for management operating performance measure is how to treat non-recurring items. Because in some industry, like, you know, let's look at, you know, restructuring charge as example. Some industry, you know, repeatedly incurs a restructuring charge, massive rev every year. Then how can we say this is one time? Same for litigation in pharmaceutical industry. Litigation is a kind of a normal course of business. So how can we say this is one time? So that's the biggest challenge.
So don't call anything one time.
Yeah.
I mean, they're exceptional, they're lumpy charges, but to my mind, we should not call anything one time.
And our group echoed that they were having a hard time with that term, that infrequent just shouldn't be used. If we could ban it, we would ban it.
But I think it is not only in one time, it's also in volatile numbers, because I think the whole objective is to exclude or to highlight these kind of issues is to better forecast future things. Okay. And if you don't have a stable kind of history, I think that is why people want to have more information about that. But it's not a tool right one time, even if you have. I think restructuring is not because it is one time, but maybe the number is volatile, because maybe you have 1 year, the number is big, the next year is low, and the same is, I think, for litigation charges or something like that. I think that is the main issue. It is not if it's one time, two times. I think it is big numbers, volatile.
So there is value of having sort of this number, which let's call it operating for a second, and then this other stuff that is restructuring or legal charges that is somehow different, as long as you, and our group was a three, so as long as you define it and you're consistent, that might, there is informational value in that.
Yeah.
Martin, may I comment upon that, because that was the reason I raised my sign, actually, originally. And I think everybody can agree that we are interested in the information, because we estimate earnings, and items that occur infrequently are important. Whether even frequent means once a year, once every fifth year, that's a separate business. If I estimate the earnings figure for the coming quarter, I'm more interested in non-recurring items than if I look 5 years ahead. Okay, the key issue is, should we include it in the income statement and create a number that is adjusted? That is the key issue. Now, what is the difference? Well, today I have the information in both the annual report and the quarter reports. It's in the text. I can read it. And now we have in Europe, the ESMA standard also, which, well, at least requires clarification. Okay. Would it be better if I showed it in the income statement as an adjusted number? And clearly, no. And the reason is the following. I've been a journalist for many years, and I can tell you one thing. If you have two figures, one is volatile, the other is rather smooth, the journalist will always take the smoother figure. And also, if we try to collect earnings estimates, smoothed figures are much easier to estimate, which creates a better working environment for the analyst, because then smoothed is better, the outcome becomes closer to the management. So if we allow an adjusted number, all these collecting of earnings estimates will point at the smoothed number all the time. And we will, after a while, tend to forget about all the other items. And that is the reason. We are still interested in the information, but not in the income statement. Maybe also in the income statement, but I don't want this adjusted number, because it will eventually fool us. Now, I'm well aware that most of my colleagues in Sweden want the adjusted number, but I'm trying to kind of keep them from fooling themselves.
Were you in group two?
No, one.
Okay, only for interest. Sarendra.
I'd like to put 2 points. The first point is that here we are talking about certain examples. In our group also we spoke some other examples. This cannot be an exhaustive exercise. What comes out clearly is this, that what is interest and what is other income have to be defined, and IASB has to take that as a researcher. Once the interest and other income are defined, the EBIT is clear. So therefore, nobody is disputing here the break at EBIT. So once the two items are defined well, EBIT will become undisputable. So the only one item which remains is the performance management operating performance. There, whether you are giving a break here or, as Peter is rightly saying, if you can pick up the information from somewhere else, like MD&A, so this number, maybe this break may be disputed or rather maybe subject to questioning. But more important, according to me, is the definition of interest and other income.
Okay, thanks, Marta.
Yeah, and to comment on associates, this topic, how do you treat them? Should they be in EBIT or should they be below EBIT? I'd like to advocate that they should be below EBIT, and that's because it's very difficult to value associates, and typically the valuation of associates is you would probably put a multiple on that. And it's probably a net income multiple, because the net income of the associate is recognized in the income statement. So if it were to be included in EBIT, that would actually lead to a undervaluation of the company, because an EBIT multiple is lower than a net income multiple. So I think it's in the interest for putting a proper valuation on the associate that it's isolated from EBIT. It actually makes EBIT more comparable, because EBIT relates to the operating environment, should relate to the operating environment of the company. And if a company has lots of associates, it seems that the EBIT is inflated compared to the to a company that has little associates. So it's a better like for like.
Okay. Yes, I just want to add some comments about management operating performance. In France, we have recurring operating profits, which is used by significant numbers of issuers. It is also well understood by users, and it allows to, I would say, there is a limited number of items between the recurring operating profit and the operating profit. So you can distinguish what is, I would say, more stable, but the performance, recurring of performance, with other impact, with other items that impact the operating performance of the companies, and it is well understood.
do they use that figure when they calculate return on capital employed?
After, I would say it depends on everyone who can make the decision to apply the operating profits or the recurring operating profits. You have the, in the notes, you have the information about the disaggregation about these non-recurring items, and after you have to make your own decision, your own choice as a user.
But I mean in the annual report? Okay, you don't calculate key ratios in the annual report. Okay, that solves it.
Not yet.
So two quick comments. One is on the associates. I mean, I agree with some of the things Martin said, some other things I don't agree with. I don't want to go into the details because we'd still be here at midnight. I just wanted to flag that I really think that we should be starting to think a lot more about associates than we have done in the past, and I think this project is really a good way to do that, because I think associates were fairly unimportant and fairly non-strategic in a world where a normal company owned all of its assets and did everything themselves. And I think as the world is getting more globalized and complex, and some ventures, especially in high-risk areas like pharmaceuticals, are actually starting to be, you have so much skin in the game that you don't want to do it on your own. There's more and more asset pooling and risk sharing and all that kind of stuff between companies. And I think, you know, companies increasingly just think about, okay, what can I bring to the table with this sort of 2-3 person collaboration? And, you know, they're willing to be the more junior partner or the more senior partner, really, depending on the specific circumstances. So I think you can't really draw a hard line between saying, you know, this is operating and this is non-operating. And then apparently I'm the only person willing to confess that I was actually in group two. You're probably not surprised to hear that. But I wasn't even the person taking the hardest line. But just to briefly explain what our issue was, we really didn't like the word management operating profit. It because we basically felt, okay, either this is the IFRS's view and then it should be IFRS standardized, but then don't call it management view, or if it's management view, it should be outside of the IFRS statements, and basically the IFRS shouldn't try to regulate non-IFRS numbers.
Okay, thanks. Sandra?
I wanted to build on what Marietta said about associates. I think that we need to be thoughtful about whether or not we just break out the tax from the associate accounting and address the issue that way, or leave it up above or below. But I think there's a lot more information that needs to be gathered to make sure that we're fully considering the impact for associates. A lot of companies, the associates are a significant part of their overall strategy.
Yeah. Sorry, you want to break out the tax, but do you also want to break out the interest? Because we're talking about EBIT.
I would likewise do that.
But you don't have the information.
We may or may not. It depends on if we're the lender or not.
So. I think it's a difficult issue. We need some further discussion. Peter?
I think the sign was over there first.
I thought you want to respond to that directly.
No.
Okay,
not directly to this. No.
Then chop, but
well, in fact, I was. I had the question whether when you refer to associates, you encompass joint ventures, or whether you're really talking about associates only.
Equity method investments.
Okay.
Yeah. Now.
Now you
are. It's me again. Hello again. We actually have a line in the income statement which is kind of extraordinary, and that is labeled discontinued operations. Out of the 200 companies that I looked through, roughly 15 to 18% use the discontinued operations line. I would deem one or two interesting. The others are using it for loss-making businesses that they have said now we will sell and so on. It is the most misused line in the income statement.
Very, absolutely.
I don't want to have another one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Unlike that, my colleague from the user side, that I like that the NPO management operating performance measure to be on the income statement, because anyway, these numbers, I'm not saying that the IASB will restrict the use of PPM or non-GAAP measures outside the financial statement, but now that we have EBIT in financial statements, we can, I think that if we have this NPOM on the financial statement, that is within the scope of audit, while that the management, all this information are provided in the outside financial statement if they are not audited. And also that if we have enough or that appropriate level of disclosures of that the restructuring cost, etc., that several years back, that we can find that which one is a regular or a frequent ones or not. So that I believe that the two lines of one is for comparability and the other management operating performance measured as flexibility to be on the financial statement are really reasonable approach.
Okay. Thanks, Guru. Final word has Malcolm on this topic. Afterward, we go to post-implementation review.
I'd just like to perhaps remind us all that I think financial statements over the last few years, I think we'll recognize, have become more of a pure compliance exercise. I think the objective of the board has been to focus on, can one refocus financial statements to make them a better communications document. We've heard that the majority of companies, industrial companies, has started to or do actually produce adjusted figures which are totally reconcilable with financial statements. Therefore, I believe it's totally appropriate for the ISB to incorporate and legitimize those measures which the management feel are important to communicate the results of their companies in IFRS financial statements.
Okay, I think we have received a lot of good input for this project. Thank you for that. Now we go to fair value post implementation review. Welcome to AIDA, who will introduce this section, and also I think maybe you have seen that, maybe there is a new technique and a technology AIDA wants to use, but the floor is yours, AIDA.
Thank you, Martin, and good afternoon, everybody. It's nice to see you again in this cozy setting today, and as Martin said, we are trialing having a little bit of fun during these sessions, and I see that 13 of you have already taken part in this little survey we have, and for those of you who haven't noticed the paper, it is just a little bit instruction of how to get online on this website, which is called Slido.com, and all you need to do is type IFRS 13. Of course, this is assuming you have a device that has internet currently logged on into our network. And there is a little question for you about disaggregation or application of information about fair value. So if you like to do that, please do. If not, that's fine as well. So I'm going to be brief. I realize we're running over a little bit, and I don't want to keep you too much. I want to focus on the discussions we're going to have in the breakouts. But we have spoken to both GPF and CMAC about IFRS 13 in your previous meetings, and this was as a part of our what we called phase one of post implementation review, when the board was gathering information about are there any matters that the stakeholders think need further research as a part of post implementation review. So our meetings then were kind of comprehensive. We simply asked for inputs on any on all areas of IFRS 13. What the board has done since is, you know, they met, they discussed the feedback that was received, and as a result of that decided to focus the post-implementation reviews on four areas primarily. And that focus is reflected in the document that was published last month, which is Request for Information on Post-Implementation Review. So I'm just going to briefly outline these areas, and I'm going to invite comments on any areas that we are not covering in the breakout, because the breakout session is going to focus on disclosures, which came out as a single biggest item that people wanted the board to research further. But in addition to review of disclosures about fair value measurements, the request information includes questions in other areas. And, some of you were passionately arguing for these during our last meeting. So the first one is what we commonly all know as a P times Q, or more properly we try to describe as a unit of account by measuring fair value of quoted investment associates and cash generating units. I don't think I need to introduce this topic much further. Another topic that the board is researching is application of the concept of priced and best use. This is in the context of non-financial instruments. This is an area there was less kind of demand for in the phase one. Nevertheless, there were some stakeholders who were quite passionate about this being an issue requiring further research, and this is why the board has included it. Another area that is a focus of the request for information and the post-implementation review is application of judgments required when determining fair value of the instrument. And when we say judgments, there were two particular areas of judgment that seem to be, I wouldn't say problematic, but perhaps require further research. One is the determination when a market is active, and this is quite important because it determines hierarchy in fair value measurements. So depending on that, you know, people decide whether the measurement is level 1, 2, or 3, and regard and related to that, also the level of disclosure that needs to be provided for the measurement. It also has a bearing on the P times Q issue. Another area of judgment is determining whether an input use in a measurement is significant. In other words, determining whether an observable input that is not based on market is significant. And again, this judgment is important because it drives determination whether a measurement is level 2 fair value and level 3 fair value. And why is this important? Well, there's a number of reasons, and one of significant ones being there is what some have described the disclosure cliff when you go from level 2 to level 3 measurements. So if you judge that your inputs used in the measurement are significant and unobservable, you have to provide much, much more disclosures about your measurement than if you determine that this is not the case and that you have a level 2 measurement. Finally, there is another area that the board is looking to do further research in, and this is, I mean, it is strictly not in the scope of IFRS 13 because it deals with measuring specific instruments at fair value, and as we know, IFRS 13 doesn't tell us what and when to measure at fair value. It only gives guidance on how to measure fair value and what to disclose in relation to that fair value measurement. But nevertheless, there was quite significant feedback about this, and some of you mentioned this point at our previous meeting. So it is included as a question in the RFI, and it deals with understanding difficulties related to measuring fair value of biological assets and unquoted equity instruments. So as I said, disclosures are something we're going to focus on in the breakout. So what I would like to do now is just leave a couple of minutes in case anybody wants to make any comments in relation to these other areas before we go on to breakout session. And with that, no comments. I'm just going to introduce the breakout. So I am pleased to let you know that all our board advisors are here, and due to popular demand, Steve has also agreed to stay in IFRS 13. And Martin, being a big fan of the So what we would like to do, we have a couple of slides on the breakout, which starts from slide 9 in the presentation. And slide 9 is just summarizing the objective of fair value disclosures and summarize the feedback that we had on the disclosures in the phase 1 of the post-implementation review. And in this feedback, just to remind you, there was a bit of contrast between views between stakeholders who were more linked to, let's say, preparers' side and the investors, and this is why we are really happy to have this session today, to have opportunity to understand these better. And this difference in views stemmed from there was a general perception when speaking to preparers that the disclosures are quite onerous, especially when you talk about complex business, that it can never be disaggregated in a way that it is useful, and therefore there's a lot of boilerplate information that ends up being provided that I think some preparers can't think of how can they possibly be useful information to investors. And particular guilty parties there, from what we've heard in phase one, were things like reconciliation from opening to closing. And bear in mind, this is all really about level 3 measurements, where we have most disclosure requirements. So the specific disclosures that I mentioned are, as I said, reconciliation from opening to closing balance. People also struggle with sensitivity analysis for significant unobservable inputs, and also sometimes disclosure of those significant unobservable inputs as well. On the user side, on the other hand, there was, we didn't speak to that huge number of users, but we did have outreach in phase one, and the feedback was that these disclosures are indeed useful, but there was a shared view that they could be made more useful by perhaps disaggregating in a way that is better, more aligned, and so on. So we're really looking forward to dwelling into this in the discussion, and to help us have this discussion. So we have, let's say, 3 sets of questions, and this is on slide 11. First set is about usefulness of information, and clearly targeted at users, but we want preparers' view as well to understand, is there a common understanding of what is useful? And then the second set is about what is particularly costly to prepare. Again, this is more focused on preparers, but again, interesting to see if there's a common understanding with users of what it actually involves to prepare this information. And then the final set is just a bit of brainstorming what could be improved, what possible improvements could we think of that would provide information that is more useful but not excessively costly. And to help us go through these discussions, which can be quite abstract when you're just focused with these questions, we did give you a private handout, which is comprised of 3 examples of fair value related disclosures for 3 types of instruments measured at fair value. So we have labeled them examples A, B, and C. Example A is investment property disclosures, B is PP&E, and example C is financial instruments. And because these examples are quite long, what we have done is split them by groups. So if you are in groups 1 and 2, then you will be discussing first 2 examples. And if you are in groups 3 or 4, you will be discussing only the last example, the reason being that's the longest example, so you probably wouldn't have time to look at the others. But having said that, of course, these examples are just to facilitate discussion. We don't really intend to analyze companies as such, and if you want to really discuss your own experience and don't relate to them that much, that's fine. The idea is really to delve into these questions that are on slide 11. And with that,
okay, thanks, Saida. And I think now Group 1 Victoria Room has to follow Gary or Aida, because they're going down. Cannon Room, you have to follow Shanwu or Peter Clark. Boardroom, you don't have to follow anybody. And then Paul's Room, you have to follow Mary or Ashley.
I'm coming back later. Yeah, where are you going?
Shanghai or something like that.
I think given that it's blue.